Welcome to Conscious Voices, a weekly program dedicated to bringing you alternative points of view and to challenging popular assumptions in order to help you be better informed and civically engaged. I'm Evan Davis, your host for this edition. Everything today seems headline-worthy, but in the United States today, the really big news is the imminent overturning of Roe v. Wade, the landmark 1973 Supreme Court decision that created the legal precedent protecting reproductive freedoms for women. The ruling wasn't bulletproof, despite it being the law of the land, so to speak. Opponents of women's equality have been trying to whittle away at the abortion rights incrementally through the legislative and legal processes, and by harassing doctors, even murdering some, and by vandalizing or even destroying women's clinics. They've been joined by the Catholic Church, which condemns abortion outright, and some of the fiercest opponents of individual women's sovereignty have been women, people like Anita Bryant and Phyllis Schlafly, who equated abortion with murder. Special ordinances had to be passed to keep anti-abortion protesters from harassing women on their way into the clinics. But the right-wing evangelical movement seized upon the abortion question as a fulcrum to leverage a broader menu of civil rights erosions and to rally their right-wing base. There's never been a time in the past 50 years that abortion rights in the U.S. have not been under assault. Yet since the passage of Roe, the percentage of Americans actually opposed to abortions has remained a minority. Why, then, have state legislatures and the Supreme Court now acted in a manner contrary to popular public opinion? There are some religious ideologues for whom stopping abortion is their singular moral crusade, and you'll find them on both sides of the partisan divide, but by and large, opposition to abortion is the pet cause of the political right, which has also opposed humane immigration reform, affirmative action, expansion of public services, separation of church and state, and lately the sanctity of public institutions, ranging from education to the Postal Service, the Endangered Species Act, and the EPA to our public lands themselves. You might think it's a stretch or a distraction to lump all of those together, but you don't have to go far or dig deep to see that all spelled out in the right's own very public strategy discussions. In today's show, we'll hear a clip from MSNBC's Ali Velshi on the history of the anti-abortion movement and its roots in white supremacy. Then Vice President Kamala Harris reacting to the leaked draft Supreme Court ruling, and my own interview with Cole Wojak, field director for Pro-Choice Ohio, formerly known as NARAL, the National Abortion Rights Action League. We'll start with Ali Velshi.
Supreme Court's draft decision to overturn Roe v. Wade is top of mind across the nation right now. But I want to begin tonight with a different ruling, one from 1954. That was the year the Supreme Court ruled unanimously in Brown v. Board that racial segregation of children in public schools was unconstitutional. The lawyers who argued the case before the Supreme Court and won included the future Supreme Court Justice, this man, Thurgood Marshall. He and his co-counsel stood outside the court after the ruling to celebrate the victory. They expressed a hope and expectation that Southern segregationist states would comply.
It is my opinion that the South will be law-abiding and will comply with the decision of the court and accept it as members of our democratic society.
I don't think there's any question about it in the South. People in the South are just as law-abiding as anybody else, and other decisions have come down which they said they wouldn't like, and there's never been any trouble as a result of any of these decisions.
It's maybe a bit of ironic foreshadowing there, because there were, of course, several critics of the ruling, mostly from Southern segregationist states. One of the most vociferous critics of that decision, even years later, was this man, Jerry Falwell, one of the most prominent leaders of the evangelical movement in America. This is a little bit of a sermon that he gave to his congregation in Lynchburg, Virginia, years after that ruling was rendered. Quote, "If Chief Justice Warren and his associates had known God's word and had desired to do the Lord's will, I am quite confident that the 1954 decision would never have been made. The facility should be separate. When God has drawn a line of distinction, we should not attempt to cross that line. The true Negro does not want integration. He realizes his potential is far better among his own race," end quote. Falwell went on to assert that integration, quote, "will destroy our race eventually." In the aftermath of Brown v. Board, segregation became a motivating factor, including for the evangelical movement. More than 3,000 private schools and academies popped up in the years after the ruling. White students instructed separately and apart from black students, despite the court decision. Some of those institutions included Falwell's Lynchburg Christian Academy, which was founded in 1967. Years after the Brown v. Board decision, when the government tried to deny tax-exempt status to segregated private schools, folks like Jerry Falwell were enraged. Other schools, like the fundamentalist Bob Jones University, went to court over the matter, arguing that racial segregation was a religious matter. They lost. The decision was nearly unanimous. The history shows that the pioneers, for the pioneers of the evangelical movement, for people like Jerry Falwell, segregation was a motivating factor long before abortion was. In fact, in 1973, when the Supreme Court decided Roe v. Wade, evangelicals weren't exactly motivated by Roe. In fact, the former president of America's largest Protestant denomination, the Southern Baptist Convention, actually endorsed the ruling, Roe v. Wade. He said, quote, "I've always felt that it was only after a child was born and had a life separate from its mother that it became an individual person. And it has always, therefore, seemed to me that what is best for the mother and the future should be allowed," end quote. In fact, in 1971, before the decision in Roe v. Wade, that same Protestant group resolved to seek pro-abortion legislation, allowing the procedure in certain cases, and they reaffirmed that resolution in the year after Roe, in 1974, pushing for legislation that would allow people to choose abortion in specific instances. It was not until years after the Roe ruling that the evangelical movement decided that coalescing around abortion was the way to unify religious groups and gain political power. The anger of evangelicals was activated by segregation, but continued segregation would prove to be a less than palatable way to motivate evangelical voters on a broad scale, not enough to win elections with. So that's where the issue of abortion came in. Senate races in Minnesota and Iowa in 1978 showed that an anti-abortion, pro-life movement could unite the religious right and give them real political power. In Minnesota, pro-life Republicans won 2 Senate seats. In Iowa, the Democratic incumbent, Senator Dick Clark, was expected to win by a landslide. He did not, primarily due to the work of mostly Catholic pro-life activists. Clark had supported federal funding for abortions for low-income women. He had opposed an amendment that would restrict abortions, so anti-abortion activists rallied support to vote him out.
Richard Clark. 6 years in the U.S. Senate and then out on one issue, the one political insiders said didn't matter.
I had voted for public funding of abortion. I'd refused to sponsor a constitutional amendment to support that, and my opponent said that he would. So it was a clear-cut case, one of the clearest in the United States, I think, in the Senate races.
The anti-abortion movement has political clout. That surprised a lot of journalists and political analysts who believed those people made a lot of noise, but not much difference.
After those 1978 races, those people resolved to make a whole lot more noise, and in a very organized way. In a letter to fellow conservatives, or to a fellow conservative, another conservative activist and the leader of the religious right, Paul Weyrich, characterized those anti-abortion victories as, quote, "true cause for celebration." Another conservative activist predicted that opposition to abortion would, quote, "pull together many of our fringe Christian friends," end quote. But that was the plan, to bottle up all of that ire that evangelicals felt about segregation and concentrate it on abortion, making sweeping moral arguments against health care that they claimed was founded in religion. That was the plan to build political power, and Republican politicians campaigned accordingly. In 1980, the Republican candidate for president, Ronald Reagan, campaigned on a constitutional amendment prohibiting abortion. It's one of the issues that helped send him to the White House. He gained the support of those opposed to abortion, and he won the presidency, ousting Jimmy Carter. The 1980s saw the Reagan administration focus increasingly on abortion and the rise of the Federalist Society and a trend toward strict textualists like this man, Robert Bork, a failed Supreme Court nominee who criticized the justice who wrote the Brown v. Board decision. That trend continued through the Trump administration. In 2015, Trump courted and forged a coalition with the religious right, with figures like Jerry Falwell Jr., to secure their backing and their funding. He notoriously released a list of conservative justices whom he would nominate if elected. His then running mate pledged during their campaign that their judicial nominees would bring an end to Roe once and for all.
We appoint strict constructionists to the Supreme Court of the United States, as Donald Trump intends to do, I believe. We will see Roe versus Wade consigned to the ash heap of history where it belongs. I promise.
And they did. Trump appointed three conservative judges. And this week, with the leaked draft opinion condemning Roe to the, quote, ash heap, we can see how this all is very likely to shake out. With Roe gone, minority women will likely bear the brunt of this new upcoming restriction on their health care in roughly half the country, not to mention the fact that the draft opinion is written in a way that could dismantle other rights, things like the right to same-sex marriage, the right to contraception, interracial marriage, privacy. All of these things are now on the table. The religious right charted this course decades ago in their anger over segregation to build power on the back of abortion and dismantle the rights they don't care for. And so far, it seems to be working.
Kamala Harris spoke at a banquet held by the women's business promotion group Emily's List after an announcement of the leaked draft ruling earlier this week.
Roe v. Wade, in its power, has protected a woman's right, her right, to make decisions about her own body for nearly half a century. If the court overturns Roe v. Wade, it will be a direct assault on freedom, on the fundamental right of self-determination to which all Americans are entitled. Roe protects the right to access abortion. It also protects a woman's right to make decisions about what she does with her own body. So to the friends, I say, we've always been clear, but today, we know our purpose. We know also what we are up against. We have been on the front lines of this fight for many years, all of us in this together. And now we enter a new phase. There is nothing hypothetical about this moment. Let me be clear. This fight requires the work of this very organization, Emily's List, to elect pro-choice Democrats to Congress. Now, at this very moment, Roe v. Wade remains the law of the land. But let's talk about what a world without Roe looks like. Women in almost half the country could see their access to abortion severely limited. In 13 of those states, women would lose access to abortion immediately and outright. Those Republican leaders who are trying to weaponize the use of the law against women, well, we say, how dare they? How dare they tell a woman what she can do and cannot do with her own body? How dare they? How dare they try to stop her from determining her own future? How dare they try to deny women their rights and their freedoms? You know, 3 years ago, when I was the United States Senator, I asked a question. Can you think of any laws that give the government power to make decisions about the male body? And the response, you'll recall, was essentially, can't think of any. So when we look at the big picture, those who attack Roe have been clear. They want to ban abortion in every state. They want to bully anyone who seeks or provides reproductive health care. And they want to criminalize and punish women for making these decisions. At its core, Roe recognizes the fundamental right to privacy. Think about that for a moment. When the right to privacy is attacked, anyone in our country may face a future where the government can interfere with their personal decisions. Not just women, anyone. And it has never been more clear which party wants to expand our rights and which party wants to restrict them. It has never been more clear. It has never been more clear which party wants to lead us forward and which party wants to push us back. You know, some Republican leaders, they want to take us back to a time before Roe v. Wade, back to a time before Obergefell v. Hodges, back to a time before Griswold v. Connecticut. But we're not going back. We are not going back. Because at our core, the strength of our country is that we fight to move forward. You know, I've spent my entire career fighting for the health, safety, and well-being of women, with so many of you in this room. And now, once again, friends, we must link arms in this fight. I invite all people to join us. If you stand for freedom, for self-determination, for the right to privacy, if you stand for these principles, stand with us. Because you see, women's issues are America's issues. And democracies cannot be strong if the rights of women are under attack. So to all here, I say, let us fight for our country and for the principles upon which it was founded, and let us fight with everything we have got. God bless you and God bless America.
Cole Wojak is the field director for Pro-Choice Ohio. Understandably, she and other pro-choice staffers have been in high demand this week by the media, but I was fortunate to meet with her to talk about what the ruling will mean here in Ohio and across the nation.
My name is Cole Wojak. I am the statewide field manager for Pro-Choice Ohio.
Okay. So we're sitting here on just a couple of days after the release of the leaked draft decision by the Supreme Court, which is very likely to overturn Roe versus Wade. It occurs to me that in all of the interviews I've done over the years, all the discussions we've had on the air and off about reproductive freedom, there's never been a time when we have, when anyone of us has not felt that reproductive freedom wasn't under threat, that our enjoyment of that freedom was somewhat tenuous because it has always been under attack by right-wing forces, but not always by right-wing forces. There's a kind of a slim plurality of people who are opposed to abortion per se, and yet the political drive to eliminate abortion really does come from not just the right wing, but the far right wing, rooted, as historians are now pointing out, in racism, a sort of a substitute for segregation as a political motivator. In fact, I interviewed someone in Arizona about 16, 17 years ago from a group called Protect Arizona Now, which later became National and became Protect America Now. And she explained that the strategy for her group, which was not specifically focused on abortion, but also on immigration, also on eliminating affirmative action, also on capturing the entire legislature, was to use abortion as a leverage issue to mobilize a right-wing evangelical base and to get that movement to flood the state legislatures with representatives that they could elect so that they could then redistrict and capture the Congress and eventually the White House and pressure the Senate to ban abortion, enact strict anti-immigration laws, get rid of affirmative action, etc. A whole slew of things. She wouldn't even tell me her entire agenda. She said it was too many pages to discuss. But it seems to me like they have succeeded over the last couple of decades in executing exactly that strategy. So here we stand now, having worked very hard to expand reproductive freedoms over the years, having made some incremental gains, only to see those eroded throughout the Obama administration, despite his being pro-choice. And now we're at that final precipice that we've all anticipated. Where does that leave us? How does that change our strategies now?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I think that the first thing that I like to say to everyone when I'm talking about this right now is that abortion is still legal in Ohio. So nothing about this draft opinion changed the ability for Ohioans, or lack thereof, to access abortion. No change between Monday and today. What this draft gives us a window into is what we've been planning for, you know. I think that, as you said, this has been a long, long game played by folks who are really committed to not playing by the rules. And at every point, if the rules did not favor them, they were changed. I mean, we see gerrymandering in the state of Ohio essentially putting a chokehold on Ohioans' ability to elect the people to office that they want to elect. If we have districts that are so gerrymandered, how can we say that the people in office are representing us right now? I think that where we go from here is we continue to connect access to care for Ohioans. And I think that folks are, you know, on the ground fighting fiercely every day. I also think that part of where we go from here is the opportunity to rebuild better. You know, we talk a lot, and I think we're probably going to discuss a little bit later in the interview, but we see that access is not equitable across the state for Ohioans. We have many, many Ohioans who can't access care local to them, can't access care in time, can't afford to access care. And so our job, our mission, our goal before this draft and after is going to be connecting Ohioans to care and clawing back that access at every step of the way. We are here. We are ready. People are energized. We are going to be fighting this. We are going to keep fighting this. Yeah, I mean, this is certainly not the end of the story. This is just a little bit of a foreshadowing of what's to come.
Well, you say that abortion is still legal in Ohio. That's because Ohio has not enacted state laws restricting abortion, but overturning Roe would make such laws in states that do enact them constitutional, or at least not to run afoul of new constitutional precedent as determined by the Supreme Court. And approximately half of the states, maybe slightly more than half, have already enacted those laws or may. Our governor currently is notoriously anti-choice. His Republican contenders are definitely going to be in the same vein. We have a pro-choice Democratic contender, but we also have a Republican majority in the legislature, thanks again to gerrymandering, not representative of the percentages in the electorate. What are the chances that Ohio might enact those kinds of laws? I know they're already making their way through the legislative process. And where would that leave us if the state does enact those laws?
Yeah, so, I mean, it would leave us kind of exactly where you just alluded to. The Ohio legislature over the last 20 years under the Kasich and DeWine administrations have done pretty much everything in their power to close as many clinics as they can and to roll back protections around access to abortion as they can. And they've been relatively successful at doing so. You know, we see less than half the clinics that we saw in the state a decade ago. I think that we are certainly looking at the reality of Ohio losing access for some time. You know, it could be a very short amount of time. That's what we're aiming for. And in that time, Ohioans will still be able to get abortions. It's just going to be a lot harder. And we also, we see right now in the legislature a trigger ban. I think it was so funny to have two huge repro stories back to back in the news, right? So last week, the Ohio State House had a trigger ban introduced. It's House Bill 598. And that does effectively, if Roe were to be overturned, immediately outlaw abortion in the state of Ohio. And so that is not yet passed. There is a Senate version. It is working its way through the process here. But the only thing at this point stopping that from going into law is Roe. So if Roe were to be overturned and those policies were to be passed, then yes, we would be losing access. That does not mean that that is in any way going to be permanent nor immediate. We have yet to see what the final decision is going to look like. You know, a lot of the language in this draft was pretty alarming, I think, in many of the ways that you've pointed out. And I imagine that when that day comes, there are going to be a lot of things to work through before Ohioans see the impact. It could be very quick. They are legal processes, so they kind of flow at the pleasure of the judge. But I do think that that is a reality that's coming. And also, folks on the ground are going to keep getting people access to care. They're going to keep connecting folks to care. And the folks doing this work are going to keep fighting to claw that access back.
Now, the anti-abortion forces had chipped away at reproductive freedoms by introducing legislation at the state level many places throughout the country that incrementally reduced the protections afforded by Roe, afforded by the 14th Amendment, etc., in hopes that they would make their way all the way up to the Supreme Court over and over until finally they would get their day and win the big prize of overturning Roe completely. And yet the draft itself doesn't necessarily overturn Roe completely. It throws it back to the states. There may be some exceptions. What exactly defines abortion in this day, with those being the looming questions? What exactly would be prohibited if Roe is overturned? Are there still aspects of reproductive freedom that could enable a woman to voluntarily terminate a pregnancy that she, does not intend, that would not be classified as abortion? I mean, we have contraception, of course, but, are there any loopholes that you can see that people might want to exploit under those circumstances?
So this is going to look different state by state. And one thing that we're going to see is similar to how we see kind of waves of kinds of bills progress through states that share policy experts. We will see a similar thing with potential post-Roe legislation coming across the country to Ohio. With the way that the law is currently written, and the way that this decision, again, not yet made, absolutely drafted, if those loopholes are apparent, they will likely be closed by our legislature. The language used in the drafting of Ohio's policies are very explicit and very comprehensive, in a way that makes it very, very clear to see where their real priorities are, and that they are not with defending and protecting and uplifting Ohioans. I think if those sorts of loopholes, if those sorts of loopholes were to exist, those would probably not be able to be communicated until we have what's actually going on. And if they're found early enough, I am sure that folks will look to close them.
I meant that as a segue to ask about legislative approaches on the pro-choice side. Is there an equivalent strategy of chipping away at the prohibition through legislative proposals that might eventually get substantiated or upheld by the courts?
I think nationally we do see that. Unfortunately, in Ohio, and I hate to bring it back to gerrymandering again, but we see the supermajority of the Ohio legislature as folks who are just vehemently anti-abortion. It's not a matter of like part of the agenda, it is their agenda. So while yes, there are absolutely legislative opportunities that I think we will see be very successful across the country, the legislative opportunities that we are looking at here are not only going to be much higher hills to climb, but we are also existing in a state that is not only rigged, but is going to continue to be rigged, as evidenced by the ridiculous commission hearing yesterday. So yes, there are legislative opportunities, and we are trying those, and we are working with the best and brightest minds to, you know, develop and lobby legislators on those. In Ohio, there are a lot of folks whose sole mission in their careers and lives are to see this happen, and those folks have cheated to win.
So if Ohio sees an outright ban, a very strict one, an all-encompassing one, would that include people assisting people in leaving the state to seek abortions in neighboring states that may not have imposed a ban?
There is not currently legislation on the books in Ohio to do that. You know, we walk this really fine line right now while we're existing in this sort of nebulous draft area, right? Because so much of this is going to come down to so much technical language in the way that this is all drafted. And so I think that is certainly something that it's hard to surprise me anymore, but that is something that I would not be surprised to see come to Ohio. But at this point, it is not something that has been currently introduced.
Not quite like Texas with the hotline for turning in your neighbors.
No, not quite. Though, you know, Ohio loves a good mass report hotline, so I wouldn't put it past them at some point. But no, nothing quite like that yet. But believe me, we are watching, and we hope other folks are watching with us.
So a majority of the American electorate prefers to keep abortions legal under most circumstances. Does not support these heavy restrictions. There's probably a limit even in the incremental push to restrict abortions where a majority of people in the U.S. would say that's enough. We're not going to restrict these anymore. Beyond that is excessive. What do you think that limit would be on the average? I mean, how would that be spelled out legislatively in the laws?
So we know that the overwhelming majority of Americans and the overwhelming majority of Ohioans are pro-choice and do believe that this is a decision that should be left up to Ohioans and their families and their physicians and whomever else they wish to include. I think that one of the things that I hope to see come out of some of the more brazen and bold-faced language used to discuss the opposing side's motivations, I hope highlights to folks how little an individual's experience means to them. And I think that if we are talking about abortion care, any abortion that is recommended for a patient should be allowed to be performed. If an abortion is wanted by a person and consented to by the person doing it, they should be allowed to do it. And I think that when it's spelled out like that, the majority of folks would agree. I mean, how mad would someone be if your doctor was like, I need you to get a tooth pulled, or I need you to get your wisdom teeth out. And you said, yes, okay, I'm going to get my wisdom teeth out. You know, it is a procedure. It's expensive, but I'm going to take a day off work. Like, I'm going to do it. And then someone who you've never met, who you've never heard of, who you didn't even vote for, told you that you're not allowed to do that. But it's a pregnancy, and then there's a human after, right? And so, like, it's not necessarily that we should be talking about this threshold of what's acceptable. It's that we need to be talking about what the threshold is of who gets to have this conversation about your body. And I don't know that should necessarily be legally defined. I think it should be, as a concept, legally protected.
So you're talking there, of course, about the right to privacy as it's codified. And that affects other aspects of civil rights as well. We talked about marriage equality. Contraception, you know, may at some point even be on the table. How exactly does that work? Why would overturning Roe affect other areas of civil rights unrelated to reproductive rights?
I am not a lawyer. I'm going to say that a lot right now. I am not a lawyer. From my community organizing as a person who can also read and is familiar with policy language, a lot of those other decisions were rooted in the protection of privacy that Roe guaranteed. To the best of my knowledge, because Roe was the precedent cited in those cases, if that precedent is overturned, then those cases could potentially be back up for deliberation or overturned as well. I'm not sure what that actual process looks like. And so in, for example, the marriage equality case, Roe was cited as, like, part of those rights to privacy and individual liberties. And so if one falls, there is absolutely potential for the rest of them to get undone. And I think that that's something that is hitting hard for folks right now, too. I think that a lot of the people that you see involved in abortion advocacy and reproductive justice and reproductive rights advocacy have a lot of intersecting identities that are protected in those rights to privacy as well. And so while we are all deeply, you know, I think folks are scared, I think they're angry, I think they're anxious, we are also, you know, looking to what this could mean in the future. And it is not a wild leap to those other protections being rolled back, especially when we see the same folks who are vehemently anti-abortion also being vehemently anti-trans, anti-gay, super racist. You know, it's all connected. This one was just their priority. That all being said, we haven't seen those decisions yet. We, you know, for a case to be tried at the Supreme Court, a case needs to be brought to the Supreme Court. We have not seen those cases yet, and we will not see those cases until Roe is settled. What that means is while we are thinking about and preparing and planning and holding space, we are also still going to lose Roe in June or July. And so while, you know, this is the time for those broader conversations, we also are trying to make sure that people know that, like, the immediate effects of this are going to happen, and then also all of those other cascading things might come about.
So there is a legislative effort in the Congress now to codify Roe, which would negate the Supreme Court's gutting of that precedent legally. It would supersede the Supreme Court's authority on that. What's the status of that legislative push, and you know, who's behind it and who's opposing it right now?
Yeah. So I think that legislative push on the federal level is great, and we absolutely need it. And if Roe had been codified before now, we wouldn't be here, right? I think that one of the hesitancies that I have about putting our faith in especially the Senate is that there are still a lot of procedures and processes in place, similar to gerrymandering in Ohio, that mean that the rules play in favor of certain folks who would not be interested in, you know, bringing that through. It would still be a fight. And I really, really, really hope that folks are up for that fight. And also, I'm a little bit hesitant. I think that we often see, when things like this happen, a flurry of activity around what can be done federally, what our Congress, what our president should be doing for us, and we absolutely should be codifying Roe. And also, we need to be looking to our communities for solutions and for workarounds for those loopholes, because we cannot keep waiting for the federal government to save us when they've had the entirety of the Obama administration and now Biden, who ran on pro-choice messaging and pro-choice promises. And now it's May of 2022 and we're here, and I would love for him to act upon those.
Now, the pro-choice movement, I mentioned that the anti-choice movement has a slight plurality. It's mostly right-wing, but there are some Democrats and independents who are nonetheless opposed to abortion. In fact, there's been a little bit of a struggle within the Democratic Party is over the question of whether or not to accommodate anti-choice Democrats or people who seek to be Democrats and agree with most of the agenda, but are sticklers on that one particular issue, which they value apparently above all others. On the pro-choice side, the pro-choice effort comes out of the larger movement for equality, the feminist movement, which dates back, you know, many, many decades, and has grown, ebbed and flowed, but generally grown to be more and more inclusive as time goes on. If the shift changes from protecting existing rights and marshaling resources to be able to provide those services and make sure that people are able to enjoy those rights, to one of trying to reestablish them, do you think that that will change the character of the pro-choice movement? Will you see more people joining from more walks of life, or is that too going to be an uphill struggle? Do you have to kind of like resell the movement?
I sure hope a lot of new folks are going to be joining in. Honestly, that's kind of the thing that's keeping me going right now. We are seeing, you know, as we expected, we are seeing folks who haven't been paying super close attention, really energized and excited, not in a happy way, in a furious way, and really ready to kind of dive in and help. I personally do think that this could be an opportunity for us to rebuild back in a more accessible model. You know, we are almost certainly going to have Roe gutted. And I think that while that decimates access and is nothing but a war on people with uteruses, I think that it does present an opportunity for us to reestablish what this care can look like locally and in a community-focused setting. I think that we have the opportunity to bring new folks in and to kind of reimagine what we want this work to look like. And I think that a lot of, especially in Ohio, a lot of us are committed to doing it through the frame and guidance of the people doing reproductive justice work. You know, Repro has a history, Repro Rights work has a history of being, you know, cis white women, white woman led work. And that has meant that a lot of folks do not feel welcomed or like they have a space in this movement. And that breaks my heart. And I think that that's something that folks in this space have recognized and are really, really trying to do better and also build in a way that does not replicate the same issues that we've been fighting and seeing since Roe was caught or since Roe was decided in 73. So I really, really hope new folks want to get engaged, and anyone who like anyone who wants to do this work, please, we have trainings. I will give out my cell phone number. Like, please, please, please call me. But I do think that if I'm forcing myself to be optimistic, one of the things that I'm clinging to this week is that with this decision and with the energy that it brings to our communities and to our country, I'm really, really hoping that we have the opportunity to build back better than we could have ever imagined it before.
Why is it that a restriction on abortion applies disproportionately to people of color, the working poor, students, you know, single mothers, etc.?
Yeah, absolutely. So we see reproductive health basically exist at the intersection of all of the other ways in which the government tries to control people, right? So if you are a 16-year-old and you get pregnant, you might not be able to finish school, might not be able to pursue higher ed in the way that you wanted to. And so we see the ability to access reproductive health care and abortion to be really, really key in individuals living autonomous lives and making decisions that are best for themselves to live the life that they want to live. And so in Ohio especially, if we're talking about you know, all of the other ways in which this state fails pretty epically, our low-income individuals, our Black and Brown and Indigenous individuals, especially folks who can get pregnant, have gotten pregnant, we see that when access is removed from their communities and from, you know, when local access is removed, it is harder to get to. And if access is harder to get to, that further compounds all of the other systemic issues that folks have to fight against every day. If you are not a person who has a savings account saved on the side to fund your abortion, sometimes procedures can cost upwards of $1,000, and that doesn't even include travel. And so if you're having to travel from home, you might not be able to afford to. You might not be able to take time off work. If you're working an hourly job, you might not be able to find a doctor who takes your pain seriously. And so you can't get the care that you need with the pain management that you need because your doctor only sees a Black woman and doesn't believe you. We know that medicine in a practice, as a practice, is rooted in white supremacy and white supremacist culture. And when you take away access that is in the communities of the people that it serves and further others them where they're seeking care, it's only going to compound the effects of the other ways in which those folks are oppressed. It's a big question.
So as it impacts people, economically disadvantaged people, that would further compound their economic disadvantagement and, in a sense, reinforce poverty in those communities. And that would have impacts, you know, throughout the community in other ways, affecting people that aren't even involved in a reproductive question.
Yeah, no, absolutely. The impact that being forced to carry a pregnancy to term has on not only the individual being forced to carry it, but everyone that individual, you know, interacts with, anyone that relies on that individual, their lives are going to change too. And while that is, I think that removing any time that you make it harder for someone to access healthcare, they're not going to want to access healthcare. And any time that you make it harder for someone to exercise their decision making, it's going to further compound the situations that they're trying to avoid.
So what can people expect in the short term, especially here in Central Ohio? Are there opportunities to get involved and throw one's personal weight into the movement in a way that may make a difference, or what differences can be made?
Absolutely. This is my very favorite question to talk about. So the spectrum of activism is massive, right? You can do something as simple as talking to a friend or family member about abortion and about what's going on and about how to talk about it. You can donate to an abortion fund. You can donate to the organizations on the ground doing this great work. I'm going to plug specifically our three abortion funds in Ohio. We've got Women Have Options, which is our statewide abortion fund. We have the Agnes Jackson Reynolds Fund, the Aggie Fund, up in Toledo. And then we have the Preterm Fund up in Cleveland. Please, if you have anything to give, give it to abortion funds. They are the ones funding the abortions and then also connecting folks to the practical support services, getting people rides, childcare, gas cards, all of that. We also, for folks who are interested in doing more advocacy and education things, we at Pro-Choice Ohio have two training series that we run monthly to do just that. So we have the last Wednesday of every month, we have a training called our Ramp Up for Repro series, and it is a 90-minute, very fast, it goes very quickly, basically crash course on where we're at, how to do this work, all of the different ways to do this work, and then also to connect with other folks in the repro space to get plugged into those networks. Highly, highly recommend. I think it is a really, really great way to get up to speed and learn how to talk about these things. And that's really one of the biggest things that we can do if we want to have the culture change that we need, is we all just got to start talking about this more. The other thing that I will recommend, so there are obviously going to be a lot of actions and protests happening across the state. There have already been some mobilization movements. There will continue to be more. I've heard of a couple events this weekend and a couple in the weeks to come. My best suggestion to folks is to use your social media and really find the orgs and the people that you resonate with during this time. Repro is so varied and so vast, and we are all going to be impacted by this decision in a lot of different ways. If you want to know what it's like working on the ground in a clinic, follow a clinic worker on Twitter. They'll be reposting stuff that resonates with them and that impacts them, and you can show up for the stuff that they share. If you're interested in funding abortions, follow WHO on Instagram. They will also be posting opportunities. So this is a really good time. You know, these next 6 weeks before this is final is a really good time to figure out how you as an individual want to fit into this work. There is absolutely a space for everyone at every ability level, at every comfort level. If there isn't, we will make one for you. But we really, really, really need all hands on deck. And yeah, please, please, please just contact us.
Great. Well, I think, is there anything you would want to add? Anything we didn't cover?
I don't think so. No, there's a gender neutrality piece that I always like to talk about. So one of the things that I am trying to do right now is talk to folks about the best way to talk about this stuff. And one of the things that we touch on most, and I'm sure you heard me mention it a couple of times, is that women are not the only people who get abortions. And so when we are talking about the folks who will most disproportionately be impacted by Ohio losing access, we are talking about folks who are trans and non-binary and Black and Brown and Indigenous individuals. When we see folks who are already, as you had mentioned, in economically disadvantaged situations or in situations where they are having to fight against these structural oppressions, those folks are not going to be the ones that can fly out of state or go to Canada and get care. And so when we are talking about, especially in Ohio, what losing access looks like and who that's going to impact, we are really, really aware that it is going to impact trans and non-binary individuals disproportionately. And so that's just something that we're all trying to do better on, talking about, you know, movement was into movement that could be, reframing the language around, you know, people with uteruses, people who could get pregnant, and just kind of keeping that in mind has been a really, that has been something that I have seen a lot of impact on a lot of folks' language. So if I can leave folks with one thing, that's the one thing that I try to leave people with. 'Cause it's important. It's really important. And those are also the folks doing a lot of the leading in this work. And so, yeah.
And I guess lastly, what is that website and phone number?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Okay. So my phone number, feel free to text me. If you call me, I might send you to voicemail first. Phone number 614-406-8473. My email is Cole, C as in cat, O-L-E, at prochoiceohio.org. Nice and easy. You can check out our events. So anything that our organizing team is doing, the ramp-up training that I talked about, and then any other events can be found at prochoiceohio.org/events. And then, yeah, I mean, follow anybody Repro on social. We are at Pro Choice Ohio. You can follow Women Have Options. If you just honestly just Google Women Have Options Ohio and all of their stuff will pop up. Same with Aggie Fund preterm. Folks are really using social media and that digital space as a connection point and as an entrance point. So yes, please reach out. And if you don't want to reach out, at least go follow someone new on Instagram and Twitter.
We'll follow this story, of course, in coming weeks and months here on Conscious Voices. How could we not? And how could you not? But tune in here next week at this time for another edition. And at all times to your community radio stations, WCRSLP 92.7 and 98.3 FM, and WGRNLP 94.1 FM in Columbus, Ohio. I'm Evan Davis, and I will definitely be back with another edition for you next week. Take care.
Marching up to freedom.
The program you are listening to is broadcast both on community radio station WCRS via translator W245AY at 98.3 FM and on WGRN 94.1 FM. WCRSFM.org and WGRN.org. If you like what you're hearing or want to get involved, please visit those websites and give what you can. Both stations are non-commercial and volunteer-run. Both stations depend on listener support. Again, the websites are WCRSFM.org for WCRS and WGRN.org for WGRN.
When the operation of the machine becomes so odious, makes you so sick at heart, that you can't take part, you can't even passively take part, and you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, upon all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop, and you've got to indicate to the people who run it, to the people who own it, that unless you're free, the machine will be prevented from working at all.